Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're here to focus on full compliance of the Constitution. One of the things we have to do to get there is we actually have to make our appeals to heaven. Therefore, it is Learn, Pray, Act. And therefore, we can move forward. The one little thing I want to remind you, because I don't say it all the time, is we would love to get a true electoral college restored. The only way we're going to be able to do this is by creating a conversation about restoring the electoral college, where we the people choose the electors. Because right now, every state, the parties get to choose the electors, which means they lock down who the president will be. And most people think, well, that's okay. But no, actually, the Constitution doesn't allow the party to choose the president and the vice president. You know, America could do much better if we had actually a really strong president and a really strong vice president. But what say you, Tammy? I mean, I'm out on a limb here. So what do you think? Let the electors actually make the choices like the Constitution dictates?
I mean, absolutely.
Well, okay, good. All right, so... I know that there's arguments on the party side. Oh, no, we want to have a sycophant in there to do whatever the president wants to do. The worst thing we want is to have a president and vice president butt heads. Now, just remember that it's what is best for America, not what's best for a person's agenda. Technically, if we're electing people with agendas where they want to come in and they want to shake things up and they want to do things their way, instead of the constitutional way, then that's not what's good for America. So there's no way you can slice this. We have to hold everybody accountable to the Constitution, and we need to start getting the Electoral College restored, but I digress. We're covering the North Carolina ratification debates, and what we have is, I believe, Mr. Archibald McLean. And he is going to speak a little bit regarding common law. So just a little short quip. We didn't get a chance to get into this last time, so let's do it now. Go ahead.
All right. The president is the superior officer who is to see the laws put in execution. He is amenable for any maladministration in his office. Were it possible to suppose that the president should give wrong instructions to his deputies, whereby the citizens would be distressed, they would have redress in the ordinary courts of common law. But, says he, parties injured must go to the seat of government of the United States and get redress there. I do not think it will be necessary to go to the seat of the general government for that purpose. No persons will be obliged to attend there, but on extraordinary occasions for Congress will form regulations so as to render it unnecessary for the inhabitants to go thither, but on such occasions.
Okay, so I think the person who said it best was Madison, because Madison actually quantified it to probably 99% of the time, most common law cases wouldn't even find its way into a federal court. Because the courts only have jurisdiction over those things arising under the Constitution, and none of those things are regarding common law. It's not divorce. It's not traffic violations. It's not, you know, contract law. You know, these basically common, I'll say, law disciplines that are, you know, broken off into these small little disciplines that are constantly, you know, being disputed, you know, a contract being disputed, a property line being disputed. So, I mean, The great thing about the legal system today is they've put it on steroids, to where they've literally created a discipline for almost all things law, like estate law. You know, just literally the wills and the handling of an estate. There is, I think, real estate law, corporate law. And that way, these lawyers can, you know, hone themselves into a discipline and work their way into the real magic stuff of where they can create their own law. I don't know if the bar gives them a cauldron and a long stick and a dark robe, but, you know, just, I think that would be a good meme. But anywho, the next one we're going to dive into is common law and the militia, because Mr. Archibald needs to speak up again. So let's go ahead and cover this one, too.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the Reverend gentleman from Guilford has made an objection which astonishes me more than anything I have heard. He seems to be acquainted with the history of England, but he ought to consider whether his historical references apply to this country. He tells us of triennial elections being changed to septennial elections. This is an historical fact we well know, and the occasion on which it happened is equally well known. They talk as loudly of constitutional rights and privileges in England as we do here, but they have no written constitution. They have a common law, which has been altered from year to year for a very long period. Magna Carta and Bill of Rights, these they took upon as their constitution, yet this is such a constitution as it is universally considered Parliament can change.
Okay, so he's making a point here, isn't he, that bottom line, common law in England was constantly changing, and it was the means of justice, but the means of justice was based upon, believe it or not, case law, or the law that would grow out of, because one of the things about common law is this concept of, you know, trial by jury, where the jury actually dictates, and they nullify laws, because the jury can nullify laws that they think are just, they're wrong. And so by going down that case, by going down that path with jury trials, or trial by jury, because there's a difference, trial by jury, then one would think that that would actually start pushing the, you know, the law down that path by the jury trial by jury. The big difference between trial by jury and a jury trial is a trial by jury, the jury is unfettered. In a jury trial, the judge basically instructs and controls the jury, and if the jury doesn't deliver the justice that the judge feels is important, then the judge has the ability to pull it back and deem a different verdict. Big difference, right? Okay, so so as he's pointing out here, this has been a migration, because in the beginning, before Parliament even existed, the judges who were appointed by the king were the ones that maintained what the common law case law and the direction of it would go. When they created the common law, common law under Parliament, under the Magna Carta, after the Magna Carta was written, they went down a different path, but they still had judges. It wasn't until they had a Bible that they kind of changed. So understanding, this is one of the reasons why when I started getting involved in talking to people about law and about our law, because everybody is clinging to the 18th century English common law. Oh, where the Bible is the basis of the law, it's the foundation, and, you know, it really makes a good line. However, the reality is this. When we look at the Constitution being the supreme law of the land, it is the one that dictates things that the law cannot surpass or change. Under common law with the Bible, in England, the idea was that if the law didn't align with the Bible, then they had to change the law. They used jury nullification, what have you, to get it that direction. However, the king would still trump, and he would still, if he wanted to, and he wanted to be tyrannical and punish and oppress people, then the king did. And what did the people have? They had petitions, they had mechanisms, but really the only way the people were able to do anything to persuade the king, they had to revolt. Because the two times in Britain, as British or Englishmen in Britain, they had to revolt with the Magna Carta, with 25 land barons drawing swords on King John. And then in 1865, something like that, the Glorious, no, 1686, something like that. And I think it was 1688 when the Glorious Bill of Rights was finally produced. But they had to revolt. They had to draw swords and actually start fighting. So twice in England alone, they actually had to go to drastic measures to get, you know, to get a better government than tyranny. And in America, we actually revolted against the king, and we were the first country, or I should say first satellites or colonies, that successfully broke away. And because we did that, boy, I'll tell you, England or Britain was looking to make sure that nothing else disturbed their Commonwealth. So they started actually going down the path of promoting the Commonwealth by giving, you know, these different states their own separate governing, where they weren't literally controlled by the king. They became a part of the Commonwealth with some autonomy, but they still pay. Most people don't know this, but Canada, Australia, all of these parts of the Commonwealth, these nations of the Commonwealth of Britain, they pay taxes to the king.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, but I've never thought about that. Yeah.
Okay, so he goes on and he's going to bring up Blackstone. Let's just go ahead and take it from here.
Okay. Blackstone, in his admirable commentaries, tells us that the power of the Parliament is transcendent and absolute and can do and undo everything that is not naturally impossible. The act, therefore, to which the reverend gentleman alludes, was not unconstitutional. Has any man said that the legislature can deviate from this constitution? The legislature is to be guided by the constitution. They cannot travel beyond its bounds. The reverend gentleman says that, though the representatives are to be elected for 2 years, they may pass an act prolonging their appointment for 20 years, or for natural life, without any violation of the constitution. Is it possible for any common understanding to sense to put this construction upon it? Such an act, sir, would be a palpable violation of the Constitution. Were they to attempt it, sir, the country would rise against them. After such an unwarrantable suggestion as this, any objection may be made to this Constitution. It is necessary to give power to the government. I would ask that gentleman who is so much afraid it will destroy our liberties, why he is not as much afraid of our state legislature, for they have much more power than we are now proposing to give this general government. They have an unlimited control over the person sworn, yet no complaints are made. But why is he not as much afraid that our legislature will call out the militia to destroy our liberties? Will the militia be called out by the general government to enslave the people, to enslave their friends, their families, themselves? The idea of the militia being made use of as an instrument to destroy our liberties is almost too absurd to merit a refutation.
Keep going.
Let me keep going because it's in. Okay. Yeah. It cannot be supposed that the representatives of our general government will be worse men than the members of our state government. Will we be such fools as to send our greatest rascals to the general government? We must be both fools as well as villains to do so.
So here's the interesting thing, because he points out that, as he asks, why is it that they're not afraid that they will destroy our liberties? Why he is not as much afraid of our state legislature, for they have more power than we are proposing to give this general government. I've stood by this, folks, that when the Constitution created this limited and defined government, it didn't dare point its finger at the states and say, you've got to change. What ended up happening was the Constitution became the exemplar in creating checks and balances and limiting our governments. We didn't do a good enough job with the states because the states have consistently been the bad actors. Boy, you get a little tyrant, a little Napoleon in the governor's office, like we have in Washington. If you've seen Bob Ferguson, he's a little man. And so, I mean, he's just like Napoleon. And he's behaved like Napoleon from the Attorney General on. This paradigm exists in the states across the country, whether it be in New York or whether it be, the slick Gavin Newsom. We have plenty of Napoleons in America. The real question is, now that the 14th Amendment has been passed, it's been a long time, and anybody and everybody that says that 14th Amendment's the problem, and I'm telling you, the 14th Amendment is the solution. The 14th Amendment is the one thing that the Department of Justice can use to walk into every state, grab these guys by the scruff of their necks, and haul them out of office and ban them and say, you'll never be a politician ever again. And then allow, whatever type of investigations necessary to try these people for crimes and let them do their time. But that's up to you and your state to hold these people accountable. But once they're out of office, they can't threaten you that they're going to come after you anymore. And that's exactly what Ferguson does. All of these people, they will use every, just like Obama. We've seen this. When somebody has that kind of power, they use their power to meet their ends. And therefore, they are, I guess the best way to call them are despots. Because they will be as despotic as necessary to be able to obtain their end. So the next passage we're going to dive into is going to be in the next day. And this is Saturday, the 26th of July. And the first comment is Mr. Whitmill Hill. And this is regarding paper money. And then he'll go into a little dissertation on interposition. So let's, now, this is interesting. Remember, each of the states kind of had a unique focus, and Massachusetts kind of had a spiritual focus, and the Virginia was pretty much really focused on, the militia, the tyranny, legislature jurisdiction. They were pretty comprehensive. And here in North Carolina, we're going to find that they talk quite a bit about the currency. So there we go. Let's go into the paper money.
All right. I conceive, sir, that the power given by that clause is absolutely necessary to the existence of the government. Gentlemen say that we are in such a situation that we cannot pay taxes. This, sir, is not a fair representation, in my opinion. The honest people of this country acknowledge themselves sufficiently able and willing to pay them. Were it a private contract, they would find means to pay them. The honest part of the community complain of the acts of the legislature. They complain that the legislature makes laws not to suit their constituents but themselves. The legislature, sir, never means to pay a just debt, as their constituents wish to do. Witness the laws made in this country. I will, however, be bold enough to say that it is the wish of the honest people to pay those taxes which are necessary for the support of the government. We have for a long time waited in hope that our legislature would point out the manner of supporting the general government and relieving us from our present ineligible situation. Everybody was convinced of the necessity of this, but how is it to be done? The legislature have pointed out a mode, their old favorite mode. They have made paper money, purchased tobacco at an extravagant price, and sold it at a considerable loss. They have received about a dollar in the pound. Have we any ground to hope that we shall be in a better situation?
Okay. So, keep going, yeah.
Okay. Shall we be bettered by the alternative proposed by gentlemen by levying taxes in specific articles? How will you dispose of them? Where is the merchant to buy them? Your business will be put into the hands of a commissioner who have no business of his own, will grasp at it eagerly, and he, no doubt, will manage it. But if the payment of the tax be left to the people, if individuals are told that they must pay such a certain proportion of their money to support the general government, then each will consider it as a debt. He will exert his ingenuity and industry to raise it. He will use no agent but depend on himself. By these means, the money will certainly be collected. I will pledge myself for its certainty. As a legislature, I have never heretofore called upon the people. Let the general government apply to individuals. It cannot depend upon states. If the people have articles, they can receive money for them. Money is said to be scarce, but, sir, it is the want of industry which is the source of our indigence and difficulties. If people would be but active and exert every power, they might certainly pay and be in easy circumstances, and the people are disposed to do so. I mean, the good part of the community, which I trust is the greater part of it.
Okay, so right there's something that is ringing out today. As a matter of fact, the pandemic created laziness and basically indolence because instead of actually getting a job and becoming industrious to earn money, everybody just waited for their benefits to completely dry up. Before they, and then when they went back to work, well, you know what? I could fall back on, unemployment again. I mean, we were making it with unemployment, where they were living hand to mouth. You can't be living today with the economy the way it is and be getting ahead, but that's how indolent people have become. And so when he says money is said to be scarce, but sir, it is the want of industry which is the scarce of our indigence, or the source of our indigence and our difficulties. It's the want of industry, finding people that will be willing to do an honest day's labor for an honest wage. Everybody wants more money than what they're worth. Everybody. And when you're in these states where they're raising the price of labor. So if you live in a state like Washington, where it's about $17, around $17 for minimum wage. Well, shoot, to get a hardworking laborer doing framing or what have you, what are you going to have to pay him? Now, if you go to a state where the minimum wage is around $7.70 or whatever the national standard is, down around close to the standard. Now you might actually have a lot of people that are willing to work. But if you're going to give away what they would call the introduction to a living wage, this is where people are able to get money for literally doing hardly anything, and they can go and pay a rent payment and, have independence without any education, without any school. There's no incentive. None whatsoever to get a degree, to get a certification, to get some form of skill. You could just be a bagger at the grocery store and live on your own and have a family. That is not a productive society. A productive society has all sorts of entrance opportunities so that you can, save money, get some skill, get some training, like hog carrying, for being a mason. Working your way up into the mason ranks or plumbing or what have you. But getting people to actually do hard work so that they can finally get a decent paying job when they can just go flip burgers for $17 an hour, what's the point? And what is really scarce, we're going into a break, but what is really scarce to me, if the way I see this, is the paradigm that it's not necessarily, the skill or the wage, it is the competency behind the individual. They will ruin something, do damage to something, they won't say anything. If you discover it, oh, well, so what? So I ruined it. What are you going to do about it? I can't bring it back. the attitude is alarming. So when we come back, we'll dive back into this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Now, I don't know what it's like in Wyoming, but I can't believe it's as bad as it is here. But I believe that it has been equally damaged because of the pandemic. Is that about right?
In Moreland or just...
In basic labor. Finding people to work, getting competent people to do work. You know, where you actually go 100%. In to get your, where you get your car repaired and it actually is repaired. And, you know, if you find a problem, then the person... I've got a mechanic, and we're really blessed with this guy because he tells us in advance, you know, I did something wrong, I'm going to have to fix this, but don't worry, I'll cover it. Or if I find a problem, he goes, oh, wow, I didn't anticipate that, that's my bad, and he just covers it. So that is hard to find.
Yeah, 100%.
Landscapers want... They want more money than a nurse who saves your life in a hospital gets paid.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Landscapers are billing over $100 an hour in Washington State. That's what they bill. They don't pay that. Oh, they don't come close to paying that. But they justify it. Oh, well, the L&I, you know, workers' comp, all these things. You know what? To be clear, folks. The state has no constitutional authority to regulate labor. It's not in the state constitution. They're imposing federal regulations. And the federal government doesn't have the ability to regulate labor either. So you see what tyranny does. And this is how it creates these problems and pushes us down into a non-productive state. So go ahead and pick it up there with where the money to be paid into our treasury. Go ahead.
Okay, were the money to be paid into our treasury first instead of recommitting it to the Continental Treasury, we should apply it to discharge our own pressing demands, by which means a very small proportion of it would be paid to Congress. And if the tax were to be laid and collected by the several states, what would be the consequence? Congress must depend upon 12 funds for its support. The general government must depend on the contingency of succeeding... in 12 different applications to 12 different bodies. What a slender and precarious dependence would this be? The states, when called upon to pay these demands of Congress, would fail. They would pay every other demand before those of Congress. They have hitherto done it. Is not this a true statement of facts? How is it with the Continental Treasury? The true answer to this question must hurt every friend to his country. I came in late, but I believe that a gentleman, Governor Johnson, said that if the states should refuse to pay requisitions and the Continental officers were sent to collect, the states would be degraded and the people discontented. I believe this would be the case. The states, by acting dishonestly, would appear in the most odious light, and the people would be irritated at such an application after a rejection by their own legislature. But if the taxes were to be raised of individuals, I believe they could, without any difficulty, be paid in due time.
Okay, so...
But, sir, the United States, go ahead.
Okay, so when we start looking at the problems. This right here is a testimony how the states were literally the problems with their own finances. They basically inflated their currency and they devalued their property. So the federal government's responsibility is to maintain a consistent valued gold coin currency, or I should say a precious metal coin currency, so that we don't get our property devalued, we don't inflate the value of our money so that it basically becomes worthless. And it's hard to do that with coin. Keep going. Thank you.
All right. But, sir, the United States wished to be established and known among other nations. This will be a matter of great utility to them. We might then form advantageous connections. When it is once known among foreign nations that our federal government and our finances are upon a respectable footing, should emergencies happen, we can borrow money from them without any disadvantage. The lender would be sure of being reimbursed in time. This matter is of the highest consequence to the United States. Loans must be recurred to sometimes. In case of a war, they would be necessary. All nations borrow money on pressing occasions. The gentleman who was last up mentioned many specific articles which could be paid by the people in discharge of their taxes. He has, I think, been fully answered. He must see the futility of such a mode. When our wants would be greatest, these articles would be least productive. I mean in time of war. But we still have means, such means as honest and assiduous men will find. He says that Congress cannot lay the tax to suit us. He has forgotten that Congress are acquainted with us, go from us, are situated like ourselves. I will be bold to say it will be most their own interest to behave with moderation. Their own interest will prompt them to lay taxes moderately, and nothing but the last necessity will urge them to recur to that expedient. This is the most essential clause. Without money, government will answer no purpose. Gentlemen, compare this to a foreign tax. It is by no means the case. It is laid by ourselves. Our own representatives lay it, and will, no doubt, use the most easy means of raising it possible. Why not trust our own representatives? We might, no doubt, have confidence in them on this occasion as well as every other. If the Continental Treasury is to depend on the states, as usual, it will be always poor. But gentlemen are jealous and unwilling to trust government, though they are their own representatives. Their maxim is, trust them with no power. This holds against all government. Anarchy will ensue if governments be not trusted. I think that I know the sentiments of the honest, industrious part of the community, as well as any gentleman in this house. They wish to discharge these debts and are able. If they can raise the interest of the public debt, it is sufficient. They will not be called upon for more than the interest till such time as the country be rich and populous. The principal can then be paid with great facility.
Yes, and so the discussion of finance, the discussion of economics, the discussion of money usually glazes people's eyes over. It's kind of like there's a running joke about insurance conferences. You go to, you know, an insurance sales conference where they just talk about, you know, numbers and insuring this and that. And I mean, it's just like it's hard to stay awake. In this particular case, we're actually finding that they've learned some real lessons, some hard lessons of losing species. We haven't even gotten to it, but they talk about the need of gold species or precious metal species for a currency versus paper. Paper has no value. Everybody knows gold has a value, and gold is a limited species. So one of the things that they talk about down the road is they're going to talk about how when a person has paper money and gold species available to them, how do you think they go and they pay for their goods and services? Which species do you think they use for their transactions, right? So which species do you think they use? Do you think they, you know, would use paper, or do you think they would use their gold? they would hold on to their gold and they would only use paper. Or yeah. in today's society, most people hold on to their cash and they use credit. And we've all learned that by using credit, you're literally taking the profits out of the local area and the cash flow out of the hands of the local businesses and putting it straight into the bankers, where they're making extra money on top of it from the transaction itself. So, I mean, everybody's starting to learn these lessons. And unfortunately, it's only when, you know, we've started to realize, hey, where's all the money going? It's leaving because everybody's using credit. Nobody's using cash anymore. And until we start demanding cash and actually incentivizing the use of cash, so that we can, I remember when credit cards actually came out, they tried to incentivize cash over credit cards because, one, credit cards took more time to do the transaction, and two, there was an extra charge on top of it where you'd get, you know, a cash discount. They started offering cash discounts for gas and so forth. And they still do to this day because they realize putting cash in hand is far better than just numbers going across their account into some, you know, bank in some other state, like Citibank or what have you. So anyway, he now dives into a short little oration regarding interposition and this process with finance. So let's go ahead.
Okay. We can borrow money with ease and on advantageous terms when it shall be known that Congress will have that power which all governments ought to have. Congress will not pay their debts in paper money. I am willing to trust this article to Congress because I have no reason to think that our government will be better than it has been. Perhaps I have spoken too liberally of the legislature before, but I do not expect that they will ever, without a radical change of men and measures, wish to put the general government on better footing. Is it not the poor man who opposes the payment of those just debts to which we owe our independence and political existence, but the rich miser? Not the poor, but the rich shudder at the idea of taxes. I have no dread that that Congress will distress us, nor have I any fear that the tax will be embezzled by officers. Industry and economy will be promoted, and money will be easier got than it ever has been yet. The taxes will be paid by the people when called upon. I trust that all honest and industrious people will think with me that Congress ought to be possessed of the power of applying immediately to the people for its support without the interposition of the state legislatures. I have no confidence in the legislature. The people do not suppose them to be honest men.
So here he's laying the case that Congress can actually do good things for the people and keep the states from interposing to basically be able to maintain their cabals. Because bottom line, it's only the rich people. Remember, we talked about the cabals when we, you know, talk about the states, you know, why the anti-federalists were so vigorously debating and protecting the cabals against the Constitution in the ratification debates. Well, it's because the affluence and the money, these men had control of it. And so when we look at how it was laying out in the, you know, in this concept of taxation, if Congress can make taxation fairer so that, you know, it's not just the poor that's going to pay taxes and so forth, that Congress can actually make an appeal to the common man to keep the states from interposing and demanding that they protect those with the affluence, those with the money, those who are paying for the politicians in office. It's the same thing then as it is today. And technically, when we really look at taxation, I'll bet you Tammy has an idea. When we really look, because everybody makes taxation out to be the bad, you know, the boogeyman. But taxation is not a problem. What's the problem? There was a petition.
Things they don't have the enumerated power to tax.
But there was a petition that we were talking about doing regarding taxation not being the problem, but spending on non-enumerated objects. In other words, we have to control spending. Taxation actually would be reasonable if we got government to only spend the money on what we've authorized them to spend money on. As long as they can continue to raid the coffers and go into, you know, the vaults and so forth and actually into your wallets, they'll spend until you die.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to dive.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's right. I don't think we mind paying taxes as long as they're only spending on what they're allowed to spend money on.
Right. Okay, so now Governor Johnston is going to add some comments regarding money, paper money. Go ahead.
Sometimes has been said with regard to their paper money, I think very little can be done in favor of it. Much may be said very justly in favor of it. That's a confusing sentence. Anyways, every man of property, every man of considerable transactions, whether a merchant, planter, mechanic, or of any other condition, must have felt the baneful influence of that currency. It gave us relief for a moment. It assisted us in the prosecution of a bloody war. It is destructive, however, in general, in the end. It was struck in the last instance for the purpose of paying the officers and soldiers. The motive was laudable. I then thought, and still do, that those gentlemen might have had more advantage by not receiving that kind of payment. It would have been better for them and for the country had it not been emitted. We have involved ourselves in a debt of 200,000. We have not, with this sum, honestly and fairly paid 50,000. Was this right? But, say they, there was no circulating medium. This want was necessary to be supplied. It is a doubt with me whether the circulation medium be increased by an emission of paper currency. Before the emission of paper money, there was a great deal of hard money among us. For 30 years past, I had not known so much specie in circulation as we had at the emission of paper money in 1783. That medium was increasing daily. People from abroad bring, is it specie or specie?
It's specie.
Mm-hmm. Bring specie. For thank God our country produces articles which are everywhere in demand. There is more specie in the country than is generally imagined, but the proprietors keep it locked up. No man will part with his specie. It lies in his chest. It is asked, why not lend it out? The answer is obvious, that should he once let it get out of his power, he never can recover the whole of it. If he brings suit, he will obtain a verdict for one half of it. This is the reason of our poverty. The sanctity of money must be in some degree owing to this, and the specie which is now in this country might as well be in any other part of the world. If our trade was once on a respectable footing, we should find means of paying that enormous debt.
Okay, so when he's talking specie, he's actually talking about a gold coin instead of paper. And okay. So they wanted to hold on to, you know, something because they knew, even, and I think even paper at that point, because if somebody didn't honor paying you back and you had to go get a verdict to get paid, you only got half of the amount. What happened to the other half? What happened to the other half?
I guess they got to keep it.
Maybe that was the lawyer fee, the court fee, what have you, right? Right? I mean, so what happens if you actually have to go to court every time to get your due? You're going to take a hit every time. You don't walk out of there with getting more. You're going to get less because you now have to go into a racket where they've padded themselves. They're going to make money out of the whole transaction. There you go.
Okay. Yeah.
So now that we go down to Monday, July 28th, and Mr. Iredell makes his first comment, and it's regarding delegated objects and militia. Go ahead.
Hold on, I gotta find it.
Yeah, it's just down almost.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
I found it.
July 28th.
Mr. Chairman, I was in hopes that some other gentleman would have spoken to this clause. It conveys very important powers and ought not to be passed by. I beg leave, in as few words as possible, to speak my sentiments upon it. I believe most of the governors of the different states have power similar to those of the president. In almost every country, the executive has the command of the military forces. From the nature of the thing, the command of armies ought to be delegated to one person only. The secrecy, dispatch, and decision which are necessary in military operations can only be expected from one person. The President, therefore, is to command the military forces of the United States, and this power, I think, a proper one. At the same time, it will be found to be sufficiently guarded. A very material difference may be observed between this power and the authority of the King of Great Britain under similar circumstances. The King of Great Britain is not only commander-in-chief of the land and naval forces, but has power in time of war to raise fleets and armies. He has also authority to declare war. The President has not the power to declare war by his own authority, nor that of raising fleets and armies. These powers are vested in other hands. The power of declaring war is expressly given to Congress, that is, to the two branches of the legislature. The Senate, composed of representatives of the state legislatures, the House of Representatives, deputed by the people at large. They have also expressly delegated to them the powers of raising and supporting armies and of providing and maintaining a navy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
With regard to the militia, it must be observed that though he has the command of them when called into the actual service of the United States, yet he has not the power of calling them out. The power of calling them out is vested in Congress for the purpose of executing the laws of the Union. When the militia are called out for any purpose, some person must command them, and who so proper as that person who has the best evidence of his possessing the general confidence of the people? I trust, therefore, that the power of commanding the militia when called forth into the active service of the United States will not be objected to.
Yeah, so can you imagine having Congress command the military? I mean, they'd have to have a... I mean, they hardly agree on anything, and they have to bicker, and they have to take positions. It would take incredible amount of time just to get a decision to attack, where a single person understanding, you know, the battle plans, the recommend... Because what ends up happening if we're going to go to war? And as a matter of fact, rest assured, my friends, that almost every contingency of possible warfare, somewhere in some dank, dark room, classified holdings, there are plans of how to execute that war. And so what happens is, oh, we're going to go to war here, because you never know what's going to come up. Somebody runs off to the plans office, and they find the plans, and I'm really marginalizing this, but and then they bring it in, and they throw down the plan or plans, the different variations of the plan, so that the president can choose which plan he wants to execute. And constantly, these plans are worked and worked and worked. And there are points in time that before there's even a hint of action, military action, these plans are already pulled out of the vaults, and they're already working through it, basically getting consensus from the president or the chief of staff and what have you, that the president wants us to do something like this, and they start tailoring the plan to meet that, if at all possible. Now, I've actually seen plans go down where the general didn't care about the loss of life or what have you. And so in some cases, this is one of the reasons why we want to make sure that the people making these decisions are on the civilian side, not military. Because too often, military, like corporate executives, are willing to put out a product that has a lot of, you know, faults and problems and failure. In other words, they don't care. They just want to meet the deadlines, get it out there, be the first. And let the, you know, let the mm-hmm. victims fall where they may, let the returns come back, and we'll sort that out later. But when you have a civilian who, you know, has to actually answer to the people, a single person actually answering to the people, then it becomes a very humbling thing. Because one of the things that Lincoln realized was his actions as a tyrant was getting a lot of people killed. And there are stories where, there was one particular story where Lincoln actually had to write a letter 5 times to a mother who lost 5 sons. And the 5th one was her last. There was no more name to be carried forward from that family. And I believe from that, they created a law that made sure that if a family only had 1 son to carry the name forward, they would not be in combat or even go to war if necessary, if there that kind of risk. But anyway, and that's a Lincoln faux pas. In other words, that law came to be because of him. So anyway, now Mr. Iredell then jumps into a comment regarding the power of common law and impeachment. So let's go ahead and cover this.
Okay, we have about 1.5 minutes left.
Oh, okay. And you know what? We don't have time because this is a little bit longer than 1.5 minutes. Thank you for watching that. So what do you think? Is there... We really haven't even dove into this. We're actually, as you look at it, in the navigation pane, we're well over half, right? When you look at that little navigation pane of the slide, we're well over half. But when you actually look at the pages on the other line, you know, out here, we're not even close to half. That's because a lot of people made a lot of snide remarks in the very beginning. And as we move down towards the end here, there are going to be longer and longer orations that really, you know, try to refute the arguments for a Bill of Rights and so forth. And Mr. Iredell is probably one of the best out of the North Carolina debates. That being said, as we look at North Carolina itself, what they end up doing is they end up stalling. Instead of ratifying the Constitution, I think that they've just opted to say, let's see if they break it or what happens when they take this thing out for a ride. You know, let's just wait 1 year and we'll determine whether we go into the union or not based on that 1 year little, you know, bike ride, right? So that's what happened. North Carolina actually waited 1 year. Right, wrong, or indifferent, that's what they did. Thank you for joining us today, by the way, Tammy. Appreciate your time. So,
you're welcome.
So as we go down this, I'll just say the last debates. We could pull up the New York debates, but we're just getting too close to the Constitution Day to be able to get through the content that we need to cover that prepares us for going into the Constitution Day. So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.